So I want to tell you mostly about a recent work with Petropoulos, which concerns deep brains in a very particular model, which is the SL2R Vesulino-Witten model, which is of course ADS3, and that's a model that appears in various contexts. So let me first say just a few words of motivation and introduction, why this is, I think, a very interesting problem, a fascinating problem, and where there are many more things to be understood beyond what I'm going to tell you here. Well, in some sense, this theory, this conformal field theory, is one of the longest standing and still, I think, partially understood problems of string theory. It has quite a long history. The first paper was written by Balogh, Rafferty, Forgats, and Wipf about 12 years ago. And then there have been a series of papers on and off. ADS-CFT has given new interest to this problem. And it is, of course, a very interesting problem for some obvious reasons. First of all, it is the simplest non-trivial string background for which time is not a free field on the world sheet. It also enters in the near horizon description of brain configurations, in particular of the black string, the NS5F1 black string, and its non-extremal extensions, generically. And it is in some sense, as is well known, the best bet for trying to go beyond the CFT gravity and really into the CFT string theory correspondence, because the string theory side is hopefully going to be under control one day or the other. Now, what I will discuss here mostly are deep brains in this conformal field theory, and those are particularly interesting for at least three different reasons I could think of. First of all, they are probes of string theory, and they are defects in the dual boundary conformal field theory that seem to be rather interesting. Secondly, and that's something I'll try to explain a bit more, deep brains are very nice tools for trying to do exact semi-classical calculations of CFT data. By analogy, actually, I'm arguing here by analogy with what we have learned in the compact case that I will very briefly review. So somehow, part of our motivation when we started thinking about the problem was that, well, here is a CFT that we don't control very well. That's the SL2R Vesulino-Witten model. Of course, many things have been learned. Maldacena and Oguri have given, I think, what looks like the correct spectrum, but many more things need to be understood. And having deep brains at hand is perhaps an alternative and very nice and easy way to try to get some of this CFT data, and I will try to explain this point a bit more. And of course, the third motivation one has in the back of one's mind are compactifications of string theory, warped compactifications of string theory, and you heard the talk by Andreas Karr that was much more motivated in this direction last week. So let me, without spending too much time, let me still go over something that you probably are familiar with now, namely how deep brains can be understood. There is a very beautiful story that has been unwrapped for deep brains on the SU2 Vesulino-Witten model, and more generally on group manifolds, where things are still not totally worked out. And let me tell you a few things about that before going on to the SL2R theory. So let me rapidly review how things work in the compact case, SU2 Vesulino-Witten model. So the first point, the starting point in some sense, is that there is a very simple way to solve the open string field equations of motion, or the conformal boundary conditions in these theories. And this is achieved by simply identifying on the boundary of the world sheet left and right moving currents up to some automorphism that I call omega. Now this is an exact background, an exact CFT background, boundary condition rather, because the energy momentum tensor has the quadratic Sugawara form. So when you impose that, you have automatically that T is identified with T bar on the boundary. So this is a very cheap way to solve the equations of conformal invariance, which are of course the open string field equations exactly. Now, when you impose this condition here, that's not the end of the story, because there is a finite Hilbert space. Actually, it's not quite a Hilbert space, but it can be given a norm with some appropriate limiting procedures. So there is some finite space of solutions to this equation, and those are usually labeled by the so-called Ishibashi states, boundary conformal states, which are Ishibashi states. And in this particular case, there are exactly k plus 1 independent solutions of this equation. So the way you construct those is by starting with some closed string primary and then creating a coherent superposition of currents here, which makes it non-normalizable, so that this is exactly satisfied. This is an identity. So there is a k plus 1 dimensional space of solutions, and these Ishibashi states have the defining property somehow that if you sandwich two of them with this evolution operator in the transverse closed string channel, you only find that closed string states in a particular representation of the algebra propagate in this direction. So in other words, these are guys which only couple to some particular spin representation in the closed string theory, the spin I, which should be equal to j here. Obviously, this cannot be deep brains. Deep brains have, all of them have mass and tension, so they should all couple to the identity operator, which includes the graviton, and therefore these are linear superpositions of deep brain states. And the deep brain states, as we all know, should be characterized, of course, by another property, namely that if one thinks about the same diagram in the open string channel, there should be integer multiplicities for open strings in this annulus diagram, right? So there should be an integer number of open strings that stretch from here to there. And actually the solution, a solution to this problem, was early on proposed by Cardi, and it's a very simple solution actually. He said that one should take this particular linear superposition of the Ishibashi states, where S is the modular transformation matrix, and if you take that actually and you define the Cardi states through this relation, it is a question of simple algebra to simply transform this amplitude in the annulus channel this way. And what you find now is that between the ith and the jth Cardi states, there are exactly nijl open strings in the representation L of the Kac-Moody algebra. And this is, of course, using Eric's formula, which relates the fusion coefficients nijl to products, sums of products of this S matrix. So that's how you construct these things in a compact Vesumino-Witten model. And once you have the states, basically you can calculate everything from them. You know, it's all in this simple formulas. For instance, the tension of the ith brain in some units, which I won't define here, is simply SI0 over square root S00. And if you plug in the precise modular transformation matrix for the Vesumino-Witten model, this is some sine function pi to I plus 1 over k plus 2. And likewise, the higher couplings, so the couplings of these brains to higher harmonics of the graviton on the sphere, are given by Sij. Those are again sine functions. And the open string spectrum, well, you know that it's determined by the fusion coefficient. So there is one open string for every integer spin between 0 and 2i, if you are thinking about the ith brain. And their mass squares are given by the usual, of course, SU2 Vesumino-Witten formula, LL plus 1 over K plus 2. So somehow the CFT description is pretty economical and very quick to derive once you know the Cardi states. But there is also a very simple, and that's what I will explain a little bit now, a very simple and it turns out exact way to understand semi-classically all this formulae. And the fact that it is simple, well, is sort of obvious a posteriori. The fact that it is exact is a bit less obvious. It's probably related to supersymmetry in some context, but that's not really very well understood yet. So the first simple but still illuminating comment was made by Alexeyev and Somerus, who simply wrote down this gluing condition in terms of the currents of the Vesumino-Witten model. So G here is an element of the group of SU2. And they noticed that even though they might very naively look like Neumann boundary conditions, as a matter of fact, they are somewhat more complicated than that. And geometrically, what they are really describing are world volumes of deep brains, which are conjugacy classes of the group. So in other words, these gluing conditions translate into the fact that the open string can freely move along the conjugacy class of the group, but cannot move transverse to a conjugacy class. So that was the first nice and illuminating remark. These guys are spheres, two spheres in three spheres, in the free sphere. And the next comment that allows you to understand exactly the physics is that you may ask, how are those things stabilized? The two sphere can shrink away to the North Pole normally if it only had tension. But there is not only tension, there is actually also a flux that you can turn on to these spheres, a monopole flux, if you wish. There was some confusion in the beginning about this, but perhaps the correct way to state it is that if you want that the Vesumino term in the Vesumino-Witten model be well-defined, there is a very particular quantization condition which tells you that the integral over a ball bounded by an open world sheet and by some two-dimensional surface on a deep brain minus the integral of some two-form that should be defined on this two-dimensional surface on the deep brain should be an integer. It's easy to see that that's the analog of the usual Vesumino quantization rule. And that turns out in the end to tell you that there is a quantized F actually, and not B plus F. F is quantized on the world volume of these two spheres. So once you notice that, the rest is calculation, and it's very simple calculations, freshman calculus calculations. For instance, let's calculate the energy. Well, here is the metric of the three sphere. Here is the B field in some gauge. Note that dB is precisely 2L squared times the volume form. And here is some constant and quantized F field. And now you just plug in all this into the Dirac-Bonnefeld action. And when I said exact, I meant that dBi will give the full answer. There are no corrections to this formula. So when you plug this stuff into the Dirac-Bonnefeld action, you get out a very simple expression. It's here. Some function of psi. You go ahead, you minimize it, and you find that the minima are at integer multiples of 1 over 2L squared, where L is the radius of S3 here. So you have one deep brain for every integer between 0 and 2L squared. Over pi. Now, if you look at these brains, let me just mention a few of their properties quickly. I will come back to those later. The size is given by the radius of the free sphere times some sign. Now, n here takes integer values between 0 and k plus 2, or 1 and k plus 1. So this thing, of course, goes all the way from the North Pole down to the equator and back to the South Pole. Their energy is also proportional to the sine function, so it's much bigger than tensive energy, and that's because there is a B field and an F field on them, so it's not simply L squared sine squared, as it should be, it's only one sine. The B plus F field on these deep brains is proportional to the sine of 2 pi n over k plus 2, so you can just read off all this formula. And the higher couplings, the various couplings to the higher spherical harmonics are given by integrals of Gegenbauer polynomials if you do it correctly, and that's exactly reproducing the sine functions of the S matrix from the Cardy states. And you have to work a bit more, it's tedious but straightforward, to calculate the spectrum of open strings or of fluctuations in this background, and again you find an exact agreement with what you expect from CFT. So all these calculations actually give exact agreement with CFT if you identify, I didn't say that, the radius L squared of the free sphere with k plus 2 times alpha prime. Now we know from the five-brain geometry, to which I will come in a moment, that this is the correct identification in a sense. Of course, the plus 2 has no reason to be there in the semi-classical limit, but somehow this plus 2 is resumming all the corrections to the leading semi-classical calculation, and there are no further corrections to all these results once you define the radius as k plus 2 alpha prime. Well, so that's what I meant when I said that part of the hope was that by exactly the same argument, we can now go ahead and try to calculate for SL2R corresponding data, say the modular transformation matrix S, which is very hard to extract from the work of Juan and Hiroshi, and other data that can be derived from these deep brains. Now, I'll say a few words about that. That's really not done yet. And there are all sorts of regularization problems that don't allow you to do it in a very simple manner, at least. Now, much more can be done about this problem, and I won't tell you more. Probably you have heard already many talks about it. For instance, if one thinks of these deep brains as bound states of deep particles, then there is an obvious flow between a deep brain with n1 deep particles and another one with n2 deep particles to a deep brain with n1 plus n2 deep particles. These are very much like the bound states of Myers, and this RG flow is exactly the analogous flow of the Kondo problem. There is also an obvious decoupling limit, a la Zeiberg-Witten, if one takes alpha prime to zero and k to infinity, holding the flux n fixed, or the number of d particles fixed. You can easily check from the formula in the previous transparency that d plus f is much bigger than the metric in this limit. So one ends up with n squared dipoles whose endpoints move on the Landau levels, of the lowest Landau levels of the sphere, and that's precisely described in a gauge theory, a non-commutative gauge theory on the fuzzy sphere. So that's, you know, a cute problem in which you can do all sorts of things. I will stop actually reviewing it here and simply make one comment, particularly interesting comment, I think, about the periodicity of charge in this theory. There are these various twisted K-theory calculations which people try to generalize also to the other group manifolds like SU3 and higher. And the twisted K-theory calculation is in a sense particularly simple here. It simply tells you that whereas naively you have only zero forms and three forms on the free sphere, and therefore you would have Z plus Z charge corresponding to zero brains and three brains, at the end of the day, the real invariant charge is simply ZK plus 2 as opposed to Z plus Z. And there are many ways to understand that, so that's what I mean by periodicity of charge. Here is one simple way to try to understand how this comes about. There are other ways. One can simply think of the near horizon geometry of NS5 brains, so I'll come back to that. So there are K plus 2 NS5 brains here, and one can just imagine that there is some asymptotic D3 brain out there, which is normal to all the NS5s. So this is a configuration, actually, which is chiral, or it's actually S-dual, to a configuration of D5s and D3s that are totally orthogonal one to the other. In this situation, the fundamental string stretched between these two are chiral, namely their ground states are chiral to D fermions, and therefore, by S-duality, the ground states of these D-strings here are chiral two-dimensional fermions. And this tells you automatically that you can only put up to k plus 2 of those without exciting them above the ground level, and that's the cutoff we are seeing in this Vesulino-Witten calculation. That's one way to understand the cutoff. Okay, let me move now to SL2R, unless you want to ask any questions.
Can you really see the periodicity that way? And if you add one more, they can annihilate.
Well, so if you add one more, what can happen is that it goes into an excited state.
Yeah.
Then that I cannot describe within the SU2 Vesulino-Witten model. I need also the Feigen-Fuchs field that corresponds to the radial direction. Okay. So a priori, I cannot do this calculation explicitly, but I can see the cutoff before.
You can see a cutoff, but not the periodicity as well.
Okay, I can see a bit more than the cutoff, actually. Let me make the comment. And that has been described by Pelk, actually, in a nice note. You can also see something more. If you just take this different brain and you translate it on the other side, you pass it through the MS5s here, there is this phenomenon of strings being created or annihilated, and therefore this will exactly map the NB strings that you have here to K plus 2 minus NB strings with opposite orientation. And this is at least one way to understand why 1, n equals to 1 up here is equivalent to n equals k plus 1 down here. Well, another way to say it is that, you know, a deep brain down here, I can translate it back up here, and that's the same state in a sense. So let me now try to apply the same logic to SL2R, actually, and see what we are getting. So we try to glue the currents of SL2R by the same boundary conditions. J is J bar up to an automorphism, but now there are some choices here. First of all, omega can be an inner automorphism or it can be an outer automorphism. There was no such issue for SU2. Now, if it's an inner automorphism, the world volumes are again group translations of some regular conjugacy classes, and there exist three types of conjugacy classes for SL2R: elliptic, parabolic, or hyperbolic. So let me just write them down a bit more explicitly. Parameterize SL2R like that, where x0, x1, x2, and x3 lie on a hypersphere, four-dimensional hypersphere. And then the conjugacy classes are characterized by a constant trace. The trace of this matrix is x0 times 2 over L. This has to be a constant. And therefore, these conjugacy classes are described by this simple equation here, x3 squared minus x1 squared minus x2 squared is some constant. And you see now, according to whether the constant is, this combination is positive, negative, or zero, you get these three conjugacy classes of SL2R. If you think of them as surfaces, what you are getting is either Euclidean ADS when C is less than 1, or the Sitter space when C is bigger than 1, or simply the light cone when C is equal to 1. So you seem to be getting deep brains which are either the Sitter or hyperbolic planes, Euclidean ADS, by considering these conjugacy classes. But there is one more interesting possibility which corresponds to the outer automorphism of SL2R. This is the outer automorphism. It has determinant minus 1, so it's not part of SL2R. And if you now glue currents like that, you get what is called sometimes twined conjugacy classes. And those are basically defined by the trace of omega 0 times G being a constant. Omega 0 now is not an element of SL2R. So this gives you a different type of conjugacy class, where X2 is now a constant. And if you look at the geometry, this is anti-de Sitter too. Okay. So you get all possible spheres or pseudospheres out by these simple gluing conditions. Here is a summary in a sense, ADS2, H2, DS2. The D instant on which is simply a point is of course also there. And this light cone.
So what's the difference
between ADS2 and H2? One is Euclidean and the other is Lorentzian, yeah. So that's Euclidean ADS2 here. Now, let me first make a few comments about this de Sitter brain. So one may ask whether one has a realization of de Sitter space in string theory, even though those are probe brains. Well, it turns out that there is a problem with them, and that's pretty obvious if you simply draw them. If you draw these de Sitter brains inside the ADS3, they look like that. They look like strings, circular strings, that come in from the boundary, turn around at some finite point, and then go out to the boundary again in finite time, delta tau equals to p. We know that that's impossible, or we almost know that that's impossible, because nothing massive can hit the boundary of ADS in finite time. So somehow something should be wrong with them. Now, if you want to make this argument slightly more carefully, you have to worry about long strings, but actually there aren't any here. So let me just make this argument in 1 minute, even though it's kind of obvious. Well, I make the argument to say something more. So let's just properly take the action for a D string, which is here, and try to solve the equations with a circularly symmetric ansatz. So you write down some rho of tau, rho is the radius and tau is the time, and you assume this string is doing some motion. The induced metric is here. Then you can turn on also some field, some electric field on the walled volume of this string, which I called A phi of tau. And this is here, the B field coupling. So what is coupling here is B plus F. And now you solve these equations. There are two equations. Really, there is a Gauss constraint, and the Gauss constraint is basically the statement that there is a quantized number of fundamental strings bound to this D string, so it's really some PQ string generically, and the Q is the conjugate momentum to the angle phi, and it is given by this particular expression here. And secondly, there is an energy, of course, a constant energy, and the energy, if you work it out, and you use some algebra here, takes the form you might have expected, actually. So there are two pieces to it. One piece is the tension of a PQ string, or of a 1Q string here, times the length of the string, which is proportional to whatever Sims rho, times the blue shift, because you are moving out towards the boundary, so there is also a blue shift. So that's one term, it's simply tensive energy blue shifted away. And the second term is the interaction with the B field. And as you know, or you may know, in the case of pure fundamental strings, these two terms diverge in exactly the same way when you go to the boundary. That's why long strings with finite energy are allowed. But here we are talking about a 1, Q string. The tension is always bigger than the Nebesschwarz charge, and therefore the tensive energy always dominates, does not allow you to go to the boundary. There are no long 1, Q strings in this geometry, that's all I'm saying. Now, what does this mean? Well, first of all, there are, of course, solutions to these equations, and these are strings that are doing this oscillating motion. They go out, expand, and recollapse. And those are actually examples of so-called non-symmetric brains. There are deep brains in this theory which don't correspond to gluing the currents of the current algebra. They are more complicated than that, and actually it's an interesting algebraic CFT problem to understand exactly more in detail what they correspond to from the CFT point of view. But anyway, those are not the De Sitter brains we were discussing. What's wrong about the De Sitter brains? Well, the De Sitter brains are surely solutions to the equation, since we have solved this conformal invariance conditions by gluing currents. But the catch, if you look carefully, is that the B field, the B plus F field, is supercritical on these solutions. It's bigger than the square root of the determinant of G. Therefore, the action is imaginary, and therefore these are solutions in some unphysical branch of field space. It's just like solutions of a point particle Lagrangian that move on a space-like curve. You know, those are the line. Those are solutions, but they are unphysical. But they solve the equations.
The induced metric is still time-like, but you're saying that the combination which appears inside the Dirac Bornin field action is
negative. So I don't know if they have some interpretation. They could have some interpretation, some sort of instantons, and they are.
Well, let me go back. And this is a slightly related question I was wondering about. So just a moment ago, you were describing different types of D-brains in ABS3. But, I mean, physically, a D-brain world volume should have Lorentz metric. D-brains, except for a D-instanton, right? It has to include a time-like direction. So if your full space-time is ABS3, presumably a lot of those are purely space-like world volumes, physical.
Well, I did. There was only one like that. That was the this Euclidean ABS. I didn't even talk about that because that has infinite action. So it's some sort of D instanton with infinite action. Actually, it's a bound state of D instanton, of an infinite number of D instantons. You know, some generalized fuzzy sphere relation that solves the equations. Those, of course, I didn't even talk about. The De Sitter geometry does not have this problem. It has Lorentzian metric. Yeah. But what I'm saying here is that it has another problem. It has supercritical field on the walled volume.
Just
When you have your supercritical field, when it's equal to G, don't you have an infinite string charge?
I'm sorry, say again,
when the field strength becomes supercritical, when it goes to zero, the string charge becomes infinite.
That's right, and then somehow it's rotated to imaginary values, so I don't know what to make of it. I mean,
but this solution will be there in
this solution is De Sitter inside anti De Sitter, yes. I think you can get similar things in higher brains. If you put Euclidean brains, you can get anti-De Sitter in the near horizon. You can get De Sitter in the near horizon geometry, but then you get imaginary fluxes typically. So let me now concentrate more on the anti-De Sitter brains, actually, which are certainly the nicest, well, the most pleasant, because they don't have any obvious problem, and the ones I will talk about in the rest of this talk. And let me first draw these brains. So if you draw them, those, remember, were x2 equal to constant brains. And actually, if you draw them, they are strings that stretch between two antipodal boundaries, on points on the boundary of ABS3. And generically, Andreas drew those two. Generically, they can have they don't go right through the center, actually, if they have a non-vanishing field on their world volume, or if there is some number of fundamental strings that are bound to it. Now, let me redraw this, because it's useful to understand better what's going on. Let me redraw this thing also in Poincaré coordinates. So, in Poincaré coordinates, if you just work out the formula, it becomes even simpler. It's actually u equals to a constant over x, where u is the radial coordinate, and x is the coordinate along the black string or the horizon of the Poincaré patch. So that's what these brains look like. They come in from the boundary of ABS vertically, and then when C is equal to zero, that's the case of a pure D string, that's when there was no F string on the world volume, they just go through, straight through the horizon, but generically they go up or down according to the sign of C, whether it's positive or negative. Now let me make here one comment about what exactly one is solving here. So those are obviously solutions to the equations, but one may worry about boundary conditions. So let's try to check explicitly that these are solutions. Well, again, the algebra is pretty simple. You write down some static string now, since those are obviously static. So you write down some static string, u of x, no time dependence. You calculate the various things, the induced metric, the B plus F field, and finally the action of this string, which takes this form here, and then you try to solve these equations generically. Now, the Gauss constraint, as before, will give you some quantization condition, that there is some number of fundamental strings bound to the D string, and then the energy equation is simplest to solve, and actually more illuminating, by just using the conservation of the energy momentum tensor on the world sheet. So if you write down the XX component of the two-dimensional energy momentum tensor, it takes this particular form here, and the static solutions must have a constant energy momentum tensor. Yes. So that's the generic solution, therefore, would be characterized by this. But now we can just look at a very particular case in which this constant is zero. Now, if you set this constant to zero, remember, this means that since there is no flow of momentum in the x direction out of the endpoint of the string, there is no force at the endpoint of the string. So that corresponds to a free boundary condition at the endpoint of the string in the direction normal to the string. Okay, so that's the situation in which you don't have to hold the string to keep it there. It just falls in. You have to hold it, of course, in the vertical direction because it has tension, but you don't have to hold it in the transverse direction. It's just sitting there. And this is the situation in which one finds, it's very easy to see, these anti-De Sitter 2 brains. So these anti-De Sitter 2 brains are precisely the D strings that fall in naturally with a free boundary condition on the endpoint. And I will argue in a minute that those are also supersymmetric. The more general solution has an arbitrary constant here. It corresponds then to generically a string that does that. It goes in and then comes out on the boundary again. And in this case, there is a force between these two endpoints. There are no free boundary conditions, as in the case of the ABS2 brain. And actually, that poses interesting questions about the dual holographic interpretation that we have been thinking about with Robert recently. Let me say one or two words more about that, actually. Let me make now the argument that these brains are supersymmetric, actually. And to make them supersymmetric, I have to move to some supersymmetric context. And the simplest and nicest is ABS3 times S3 times T4 or K3. So I'm looking precisely at the background of the NS5F1 black string, which, as you know, is described by this exact conformal field theory, SL2R cross SU2, at the same level times U1 to the 4. So what we are having here are Q5 NS5 brains, Q1 fundamental strings. The five brains wrap the T4. Both of them extend along the x direction of the ABS3 space. Okay? U is the radial direction, and the three sphere is surrounding the whole thing at fixed radius. And the identification of the radius, both of ABS3 and of S3, is that L squared is the number of five brains in string units, and that's K plus 2 alpha prime. Okay, now, clearly in this background, there are ABS2 times S2 solutions. That's pretty obvious in many ways, either by checking that the DBI action factorizes, so you can solve it separately in ABS3 and in S3, or by tensoring the corresponding conformal boundary states, which were exact. So we have solutions that are the cross product of ABS2 and S2. Let me now argue that these solutions are supersymmetric. Well, one way to make the argument is by using the conformal field theory. So let me make this argument like that, so that I can make one comment also in the end. So let me first supersymmetrize these Vesumino-Witten models by adding left and right moving fermions. Those are free world shape fermions with an index which is a flat tangent index in 10 dimensions. And of course, the zero modes of these fermions in the Ramon sector become gamma matrices, and one has the usual GSO projection of supersymmetry in type 2b, say, which tells you that the product of all gamma matrices on Q is Q, and the same for Q bar. Now, on the other hand, there is one more chirality projection in this theory, and this comes from the fact that if you look at the super Virasoro generators, or the Waldschmidt supercharges of the string theory, they have the usual piece, current times psi, but they also contain a trilinear piece, which is FABC, psi A, psi B, psi C, actually. Therefore, on a covariantly constant spinor, this thing will drop out because the current will vanish, but you will be left with one more condition on the gamma matrices, which is that FABC, gamma A, gamma B, gamma C should be equal to zero. And this is exactly a chirality projection, which tells you that the product of all gammas other than the four corresponding to the four torus, the trivial four, on Q should also be equal to Q, and the same for Q bar. So this reduces precisely supersymmetry by a half, right? That's what you expect. You have 32 supercharges in the beginning. The NS5F1 geometry breaks them to one-fourth of those, but then there is a superconformal enhancement, and this background has exactly one-half times 32 supersymmetries. Well, now let's think about the deep brains. If you glue the deep brains, for the deep brains, you glue the fermions exactly in the same way that you glued the currents. So psi A has to be omega psi bar A. I'm sorry, there's a bar here. And now you work out what this means. Well, this induces some appropriate automorphism in spinor space. I called it big omega. Big omega turns out to be simply the product of two gamma matrices, gamma plus, gamma minus. And therefore, the deep brain generically is going to identify Q with omega capital Q bar. And all you have to do to check supersymmetry is to make sure that this operator here respects the chirality projections that I wrote up there. And that's true. It's a product of two gammas, and both of them are within the ABS3 times S3 part of this geometry. So these are supersymmetric brains, and actually they respect one half of the superconformal symmetries of the background. Now let me notice that if you were to do the same argument for the BTZ black hole, and I won't talk here about the BTZ black hole, then supersymmetry will break down, since of course in this case you will, even in the extremal BTZ geometry, you are doing an orbifold which is a rotation in the left or the right moving part of the current algebra. This will throw away either the Qs or the Q bars, and there is no way you can then glue Q and Q bar on any deep brain to preserve supersymmetry. So these brains are non-supersymmetric in, even in the extremal black string geometry. They are only supersymmetric when there are only NS5s and F1s. And what do they look like? Well, I'm sorry. So one may ask, first of all, whether these brains remain supersymmetric if you try to expand them out now to the asymptotically flat region, away from the near horizon throat. And that's a bit tougher, actually. We haven't really worked this out carefully, but I think the answer should be yes. Obviously, you see, what would be happening is that there is some PQ string moving in here. It will hit the NS5F1 black string here, and it will form some supersymmetric junction generically. Now, a priori, this junction means that there would be a non-zero angle at the junction between the upper and the lower part of the NS5F1 string, but we are working here in a limit in which this is much heavier than the probe PQ string, and therefore this angle goes back up to zero. So it takes some more analysis to convince oneself that supersymmetry will be preserved in the asymptotic geometry if you were to continue this out. So by the way, yeah, so those are the brains I'm discussing here, right? So this is the ADS2 brain in the Poincaré coordinates. This is schematically the two-sphere, and the two-sphere is actually threaded by both magnetic flux and dual electric displacement flux, precisely so as to give it the quantum numbers of a PQ string. So that's a different brain, but it only carries PQ string quantum numbers. Okay, it doesn't carry any different brain charge. Now,
I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit confused. So this is a D3 brain wrapped on an S2.
Yes.
But you're extending out to the asymptotically flat region. So the S2 is getting big?
Correct, yeah.
So it's very massive.
No, not necessarily. Well, it could be. So the question is, of course, if you extend it out to infinity, you will get infinite mass at some point. Now, you can either extend. Well, let me put the next slide on them. So what we are describing here is some PQ string moving in, then joining with this background, which has only NS5 and F1 in the beginning, and then making some other black string here, so there's some supersymmetric junction, and only zooming on the near horizon region. And if I want to move out here, either the PQ string will indeed continue like that, and it will carry infinite mass, or I can blow it up into a D3 brain, you see, so I can blow it up asymptotically into some D3 brain that is normal to the NS5 F1 strings. And again, of course, the mass of the probe is infinite, okay? But that's some asymptotic D3 brain that is joined by a PQ string with the MS5 F1 string. And actually, that's the setup in which the geometry on this D3 brain, well, I'll make this comment later, but since we discussed it yesterday, would be that of a Reisner-Nordström black hole. Okay? But I'll make one more comment in a moment.
This is also the original picture you almost drawn with the SU2 case.
That's correct, yeah. So one, of course, of the very interesting questions is how you describe this in the dual boundary CFT. I really don't have too much to say about that, but it's an obviously interesting problem, and I hope progress will be made very soon. Let me make here one other remark, though, which I find intriguing and which I think bears directly on the discussion of warped compactifications and Randall syndrome realizations in string theory. Now, I gave you an argument by using simply two-dimensional world sheet arguments about why these things are supersymmetric. Now, at first, you may be puzzled about this, because you may say that if these brains are supersymmetric, I should be able to see it also from the world volume point of view of the D brain. So there's some D3 brain, there's some U1 gauge theory on the D3 brain. It should be supersymmetric. With the low energy limit, I should get some supersymmetric Young Mills living on ADS2 times S2. Now, of course, ADS2 times S2 has covariantly constant spinors only if the radii of ADS2 and S2 are equal. And that's where you might think there is a contradiction or a puzzle, because if you calculate the radii, and I did that for the sphere before, remember, I didn't do it for the ADS, but let me give you the answer. The radius of the sphere, remember, was the radius of the background, big L, times some sine function, so it's at most the radius of the background, or smaller, if you shrink the sphere up to the North Pole. The radius of ADS goes in the other direction. Actually, it's given by the radius of the background times the ratio of the tension of a PQ string to the tension of P, B strings only. And therefore, there is an inequality here. The radius of ADS is bigger than L, and that's bigger than the radius of S2. The two radii are only equal in the special case when Q is zero and pi is PL squared. Whereas the supersymmetry proof was true always. Right? I didn't use the values of P and Q to argue for supersymmetry. Now, of course, the resolution here, if you think a bit, is obvious.
Could you argue just by computing the holomy of the space to see if there are covariant constant spinors? How does the radius come in?
Well, all I'm saying is that I'm not thinking about the super Young Mills theory, the low energy super Young Mills living on this D3 brain with an ADS2 times S2. And so what I'm saying is that, the condition for a covariantly constant spinor in the end turns out to be that it should be Ricci flat. Ricci scalar equals to zero, right? Ricci scalar equals to zero tells you that the two radii have to be equal, right? So that.
With respect to which metric, is this the so-called closed string metric?
So that's the point. Thanks, Jacques. So the point is, of course, that that's the wrong metric, right? We are using here the closed, I used implicitly the closed induced metric, but the right metric is the open string metric. So, of course, that's the simple resolution of the puzzle, right? You really have to think about this in the open string metric. Now, if you calculate the open string metric using the standard formula, and that's okay because this two form is closed on this geometry, it is very simple to see that the two radii are both equal and equal to the radius of the background of ADS3 cross S3. So somehow the effective radius of this D3 brain is frozen to that of the embedding space. There is no way to flatten it out, even though from the supergravity calculation, you think that by fine-tuning parameters, you can flatten it out. Actually, fine-tuning parameters here is equivalent to saying that you take Q to infinity. If you take Q to infinity, you flatten out more and more this ADS2 brain in the induced metric, but in the effective open string metric, it's always stuck to the maximal curvature, and that's the curvature of the background geometry. Now, you may say that's, of course, a toy example. I mean, I don't want to make more than that for the moment. On the other hand, there are some hand-waving, at least vague reasons to believe it might be a more general property. Of course, to really think about the analog of that in four-dimensional examples, you have to have some knowledge of what the effective metric in the presence of Ramon-Ramon fields looks like, and that we don't really know. However, the CFT point of view seems to be rather suggestive, because another way to understand what is happening here is the following, actually. Try to think about the spectrum of open string vertex operators which live on these deep brains. Okay. Now, this spectrum is exactly the same as the spectrum of closed string vertex operators. Actually, it's a holomorphic half in some sense. So the conformal weights are JJ plus 1 over K plus 2, whether you are speaking about open or closed strings. And of course, if you know the spectrum by a hit kernel type of argument, you can deduce the curvature of the background. Or if you want, these are solutions to a covariant box equation with some specified curvature. Okay. So somehow all we are saying here is that there is no way in this example to separate the curvatures of the brain from the bulk, simply because that would mean that you would have to modify completely the open string spectrum as compared to the closed string spectrum. Now, I don't know if there is any way to try to make this into a more general argument when you have Ramon-Ramon backgrounds. Yeah, I gave it a little thought, but I didn't go very far. But this point of view makes it suggestive that this might be a more general property, and that could be an obstruction, of course, to Randall's syndrome type of realizations in string theory, where you tend to implicitly always assume that the correct metric that the fields on the brain see is the induced metric and not some effective different metric. I think I said what is in this transparency. I have a few more things to say, but maybe I'll stop here and I can sketch them if you want in words. Let me just show a few of the obvious questions that have to be understood here. Well, one question is to understand correctly the open string spectrum in these deep brains, and there's one case which is particularly simple. That's the case when there is no electric field on the brain. That's the brain that goes straight through the center of ADS2, and there you get exactly a holomorphic half of the Maldacena-Oguri spectrum for the bulk. There are many ways to see that that's obviously correct anyway. The problem when this brain's curve is more subtle, I think Hiroshi has made progress on that from what he described to me, and they are probably writing a paper very soon. So that's certainly one of the interesting problems to think about. I already said that the holographic dual is an obviously very interesting problem. Back reaction and gravity, well, you heard Andreas. I haven't thought much about that. There's one other little problem where there is also a very nice analogous story, which is to consider orientifolds in these geometries. And that's some work that we are finishing with Windy and the student Kusu, Nicolas Kusu, and that should come out hopefully soon. That's more or less some of the questions I can think of, and maybe others. I think I'll stop here.
Are there any questions? Can you say a couple words about the image of these ADS brains in a boundary conformal field theory?
Well, I can say a couple of words, not much more. So obviously, what these things are obviously domain walls, I said, that are separating two CFTs, right? Some CFT1 and CFT2. Now, here you know, you sort of know what the CFTs are, of course, they are both.
Let me get myself organized. So yeah. If you lift it up away from the conformal field theory, in the ultraviolet into a gauge theory, the, whatever it's called, a D1, D5 gauge theory, then there would be a Wilson line of some sort.
Some sort,
okay, so if you have a one-dimensional trace in this two-dimensional plane, okay, so then you go into the infrared and it's some one-dimensional trace of something.
Correct.
And that's the dividing line that you're drawing.
Yes.
Okay. Correct. So that's what we're talking about.
So I'm already in the infrared, right? And in the infrared, it has to be some conformal and supersymmetric, actually, superconformal defect separating two superconformal phases of the same or of different CFTs. Actually, the central charge may jump here. It doesn't have to stay the same. Both the moduli and the central charge changes. Now, of course, one of the questions is how to correctly describe this.
Right.
As I said, we are discussing with Robert about that. We have some tests we are trying to check.
What operator describes that defect or the boundary conditions?
But those are pretty nasty CFTs.
Why are they nasty? They're nasty because they don't know, understand them. Could you play with the orbifold example?
Replaying the second of more naive examples.
You want to play the orbifold. But I mean, not even the orbifold, maybe I'm just following the lines you're talking about. You have this S1 to the 4M mod SN or something.
Right.
And SN is some residue of the gauge symmetry.
Yes.
So somehow what you want to do, in a CPM model, it's a signal model with some sort of gauge symmetry in it. You want to build a Wilson line out of that. Mm-hmm. And to make a, to get a Wilson line in a sigma model. I mean, is that the kind of thing you're, that you expect to happen?
Well, we have been playing with even simpler models, you know, free fields, trying to understand exactly what happens and how. But you're right, I mean, that's probably, you know, a next step. And there are various ways to try to understand this. With free fields, it should be simplest if there are such things, right? They should be there already with free fields. And those are already hard enough to understand. So.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because it's interesting whether you need things more than local operators in the field theory to understand the bulk dynamics.
Okay.
You know, sort of.
Right, because these are not kind of average conformal field theory fields.
Yeah. Right. So how much more?
Well, these are not fields. Right? These are sources. Okay. Whatever.
You know, Wilson lines are. You know, you say, well, gauge theory is Wilson lines, but in a sigma model. You know,
those are called dimension one, of course.
Nobody would write line would write down something like this. Yeah. And, I guess in the gauge theory, you probably can build analogs, like this, right? Like higher dimension things separating different kinds of gauge theory. Mm-hmm. So these are rather general.
Well, one thing,
maybe it's five process five. You could build something like this occur there, some higher dimensional D-brain that ends.
I think so. Yeah, you can get different superconformal super young mills separated by a wall, so which has some superconformal theory.
You peel off some D-brains and you have SUN1 on one side.
Yeah,
SUN2.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Actually, if you think about the sigma model somehow as an instanton moduli space, right? So raising the central charge also kind of adding an instanton. You add some kind of more strains to it. So you have kind of operations which bring you from one conformal field theory to another.
But so in the gauge theory, that sort of makes a little bit of sense, but in the conformal field theory, they just look ridiculous.
Well, why do you say it makes sense in the gauge theory more than in?
In a big gauge theory, you can imagine Higgsing and getting from big SUN to little SUN.
Oh, I see, yeah, but I don't think those are Higgsing ones.
But if it flows to the infrared, then you know there must be similar picture in some conformal. Take that gauge theory intuition and let it sort of run.
Well, but don't you lose the bigger SUN though? Well, I see. You mean in the bigger C, there's some way of losing the C by some relevant operator. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe you're right.
I just want to make sure I understood what fields are turned on the D three brain. So you have this background. You're putting a test D three brain. Now you said you need the monopole field sort of to stabilize it on the two spheres.
Yes.
Right. So on the D three brain, you have a background. You want gauge field, I guess, which is in some sort of monopole.
Yes.
Configuration for the two spheres. Is that the only background field?
That's the only one you need. Now you can, of course, also turn an electric field. You make it into a dion. And that simply has the effect of curving your ABS2 part of the brain, but you don't have to put that. So generically, from the point of view of this asymptotic D3 brain, you are describing some dionic solution, some dionic black hole, one in this bizarre metric.
Any other questions? Okay. Let's thank our speaker. Thank you.